at Austin. Mr. Ryan.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Bert Ryan. I'm representing Abby Noel Fisher and Rachel McCallowitz in this case. This case calls upon this Court of Appeals to apply the Supreme Court's strict scrutiny teaching in Grutter versus Bollinger to the fundamentally different circumstances at the University of Texas, circumstances that test the constitutional boundaries of Grutter's holding. The parties don't agree on much, but they do agree that the strict scrutiny applies. That is, that in order to sustain the use of race in its admissions process as a factor, Texas must show that that use of race serves a compelling state interest and is narrowly tailored to the achievement of a defined objective. Now, just to recap very quickly, because context matters, as the Supreme Court says, in Grutter, where the court endorsed the Michigan Law School's decision to add race as a plus factor in its holistic individualized admission system, at the point of decision, here's where the University of Michigan Law School was. It had made an academic decision, a decision accorded deference by the court, that its educational mission required the admission of a class that was diverse in all aspects. They were looking for a class with diverse ideas, diverse talents, diverse interests. That was part of their system, and one aspect of the diversity that they sought for educational reasons was a racial diversity. That was part of their mission. It was a pre-existing mission. Michigan Law School had experience, and they had determined from that experience that the result of using their all-across-the-board holistic system with a heavy emphasis on academics, which was because, as Justice Thomas pointed out, they were running an elite law school, that they were going to produce an admission class with less than 5% minorities, African-American, Hispanic, and Native American. That was their experience. That was the predictable future of their experience if they carried on.
Mr. Ryan, on its face, I'm going to tell you that it appears that this Texas plan is rather, is plainly crafted very, very carefully to comply with the Grutter. I mean, it is, and it reflects a great deal of attention to those details. Specifically, what is the flaw in the program? Just go ahead. Exactly where do they go wrong?
Well, in its techniques, it looks like Grutter. It observes certain no-nos, boundaries that the Supreme Court set. There are no quotas. There are no automatic point injections. So in its detail, it's fashioned to look like Grutter.
It appears to use race contextually. That is, race is considered, but they don't tally it up as they go. They look at it as one of in the personal evaluation factor. They look at an individual that they're a minority, and given the other context of what you're doing, they judge the performance, et cetera. Now, that seems to me to be perfectly permissible under Grutter. Do you disagree with that?
Yes, I'll explain why.
Okay.
Because there's a threshold decision there. The threshold decision is that given the circumstances faced in 2004, it was appropriate to add race as a specific factor in the process.
All right. If Texas had not had the history of the 10% admissions program, what would be the flaw with the program that in place?
The technique, the idea of a plus factor.
The program as is, change nothing, hold constant the program in place, but take out the 10% program. Now, how would you fault it then?
Well, if the top 10 were taken out, they might have been in a similar position to Michigan with a predictable dearth of minority applicants, but that's not what the reality was in 2004.
I understand that, but I'm trying to isolate is the role in your argument that the 10% plan plays.
Is a critical role because it is the pre-existing state of affairs at the point of decision.
You're just saying bottom line is they didn't need to use race at all given the 10% plan.
Well, I'm saying that when they came to decide in 2004, shall we add race post-Grutter to our decisional framework, they had two subsystems in place. They had the top 10%, which was predictably giving them a substantial body and a growing body of minority admissions, and they had an AIPAI system with a special circumstances category, which was also feeding minority admissions. Both of those things existed. Both those taken together we're producing about 21% minority admits. If you confine that concept to Hispanics and African Americans, if you look at the campus overall and consider Asian Americans, who Texas looks at as a minority for the purpose of looking at their classrooms, it's about 40% a minority campus. That is not what you saw at the University of Michigan. You had a 4% minority campus surrounded by what appeared to be a 90.
Well, if you accepted the numbers that were in place, then immediately post Hopwood, there, for example, black enrollment dropped about, 1.4% or so. And you had a sort of proportional drop in Latino, et cetera. At that point in time, if the present plan had been put in place, what would have been the, it would have, how would you fault it?
Well, if it had been put in place immediately post Hopwood,
yes.
And they'd have to put the AIPAI in place. That was not a pre-Hopwood system. But if they just used the AIPAI, they might have been in Michigan's position. They might have been in an unsatisfactory absence of critical mass, and they might have said, okay, the thing we're going to do is to remedy this by a plus factor based on race.
Well, then I take it then that what the point, the focus of your argument is that there is you can express quantitatively that amount of diversity that is sufficient and no more. You peg it at 21.
We're not asking for a hard line because the circumstances that constitute a properly diverse environment may vary state to state, depend on local conditions, cultural history, a whole bunch of things. But what we are saying is you look at where you are with the systems in place and you must ask the question, do we have meaningful representation of minorities? That's what the Supreme Court said. And it's not just percentages. It's a question, is it a comfort level? Do the minorities feel isolated? Do they feel like spokespersons for their race? Is the campus environment hostile? I mean, all those questions have to be asked. What Texas did was to say, let's ignore everything that we've done between Hopwood and 2004, which included the top 10.
I thought they did a study in, I don't remember the numbers now, 6,000 classes, 4,000 had no minorities in them on campus.
Well, and I would certainly get to that because if you look at how did they justify what they did? Why did they decide to do more when they were already doing a great deal through the top 10 system and the AIPAI? And the first justification is, of course, well, it's our decision, leave us alone, there is no strict scrutiny. I mean, they say, unless we're in bad faith or unreasonable, you can't bother us. And that falls because what the Supreme Court said is the goal of having a diverse environment is an academic goal, and you can accept it, and First Amendment freedoms say we're not going to overcall it. If you want to have a purely elite university, be our guest. If you want to have a diverse university, that's a worthy goal, and we won't interfere with it. But the means and the degree to which you pursue it is something that's subject to strict scrutiny. You can't just say the goal justifies any means.
We understand it needs to be narrowed, et cetera, et cetera,
But if you get to the specific,
means here are to achieve what end?
All right, and that's a good question. The means are to achieve critical mass, the Supreme Court says.
Well, I understand that. That's what I'm getting.
And the Supreme Court says.
But you say 21%, you somehow arrive at 21% is critical mass, and hence they need never have gone.
Well, that's correct, sir. And what we're saying, Judge Higginbotham, is that they were at 21%. It was meaningful representation. They had a campus that was 40%. Minority by their own definition, there was no compelling reason.
That includes Asians who are overrepresented, so.
Well,
doesn't it?
Those words only are demographic. What we're saying is that
sure.
If you're looking for a campus environment, what are there people of color on the campus? The answer is they're 40%. So it's not Michigan where you have a few minorities in a sea of white students. Texas is very different in 2004 from Michigan when Michigan initiated the Michigan plus system. So that's one thing. What this Texas said is, well, we found with no measuring stick at all that there wasn't a critical mass. And you say, well, why? And we through this case said, well, what was your basis? Where did you have to bear strict scrutiny. How did you define critical mass? And the only thing they've ever said is, as long as we're short of representation proportional to the demographic composition.
Yeah, well, how did the High Court define it, in fairness to the
That's not what they said. What they said is, we define critical mass in terms of what our classrooms look like, which is a perfectly legitimate, it seems to me, way to assess that. And they didn't take a few classrooms. They took a lot of classrooms and their measuring stick for what kind of classroom was not the huge lecture hall, which they have some of, though you don't see that in their brief, but was the smaller classroom, which they're proud of and which they have a lot of. And they said, we don't have a critical mass in those classrooms, and that's a problem for us from an educational standpoint. What's wrong with that decision?
All right, and that really was their second justification. The first one was basically, we haven't reached critical mass somehow because we're not proportional. That's what Judge Sparks thought they could be after, and he said if they're after it, they're doing a lousy job. We don't credit demographic representation. That's societal remediation. The Supreme Court has said no. They did conduct this survey, this snapshot of classrooms, and said, well, look, if we look at the classrooms, we have many classrooms in which there are no African Americans and some with
a lot of them.
A lot of them. And the question then becomes, if you have that situation and your responsibility under strict scrutiny, what have you done to analyze the reason? Because if you look at the numbers, because they're assessing that classroom on the basis of Asian Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics, and you've got 40%, and you're looking around the classrooms and say, where are they, and why are they not in those smaller classes?
But
there's nothing in that study that would tell you the answer to that. And to fashion a remedy, a narrowly tailored remedy, you've got to understand the difficulty and address the difficulty. A brute force solution that just says, if I admit more minorities, I'll solve the problem, isn't going to work. And let me tell you that in this record, if you look at where these classrooms were post-Hopwood, when admission was down, versus 2002 and 3, they didn't improve much. And how can it, and so if you've got a history that says just increasing numbers, going from 15 to 21% doesn't move the needle, you've got to ask again, what do I need to do to move that needle?
Let me ask you another question about critical mass. And you, as I listen to your argument and read it, you point to Michigan and the numbers they had and the necessity of it, with a sort of an implication that critical mass is pretty much the same, ought to be pretty much the same, university to university, and not going to shift that much now.
It may, and as I said, we don't have a fixed number that says this number is critical mass. There are many ways to analyze it, but you've got to do it.
Well, let's see if we're on the same page about this. As I read Justice O'Connor's opinion, she says that critical mass varies with the composition of the applicant pool. Or she sort of, and she said that in responding to Chief Justice Rehnquist's suggestion that the law school's admission program was a de facto attempt at at racial balancing. And she says, as the Chief Justice concedes, the number of underrepresented minority students who ultimately enroll in the law school differs substantially from their representation in the applicant pool and varies considerably for each group from year to year. So what I'm getting at is in looking at the awkwardness of trying to narrowly tailored to an end, and the end is an amorphous kind of thing that the Supreme Court, in fairness to Texas, doesn't tell us a whole lot about either. What about the applicant pool at Texas? Now they've got an expanding applicant pool too, and so if you hold the percentages constant, you're going to get a lot more numbers, but you don't have that larger change shift in the numbers.
Well, I mean, I think in a sense, the applicant pool will reflect the community from which you draw students. Michigan's a national law school. It was drawing students from a very broad pool.
Texas tends to think of itself as a national program,
well,
too.
But there are Texas
and they came close in the football field, but just not quite.
I think that Texas uses a system of Texas admits, and they separate those from out-of-state admits. Out-of-state admits and foreign admits are not considered in the same system. And so actually, they use as the denominator for their 21%, the full student body, but they really should use 90% of it, because that's a Texas admit, so the ratio is higher. And I think the many characteristics of the state could have been used, theoretically, to formulate a concept of critical mass and meaningful participation, I think everything we've seen and all their own statements prior to 2004 said, we've solved the problem of Hopwood. We've reattained our where we were going. Well, if you're saying that, what is the necessity? Because critical mass is kind of a concept of necessity. We must pick up the numbers. And as to the classroom, I think that that gets into the issue of narrow tailoring. If that's your problem, then what you've got to do is look at it and say, is there something that's causing this? Because as we expand numbers, we're not making any headway. And if we're not making any headway, we've got to reexamine that and ask the question, why not? Where are we going? Is there something more narrowly tailored that we can do to get ourselves in the position that we seek? And I see that my time's up, so I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Yeah, you have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Plaintiffs admit that UT's admissions methodology is constitutionally indistinguishable from the policy upheld in Grutter. They only argue that UT does not need such a policy. Now, we submit that there are really a number of problems with their need argument, but I'm going to focus on one particular defect that I believe is dispositive of their claim. Plaintiffs say that UT would have achieved a critical mass of one minority group back in 2004 if only we had lumped that group together with an entirely different minority group. But lumping different groups together into a single undifferentiated mass is precisely the kind of white versus non-white binary conception of race that the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected, and even plaintiffs rejected below. Indeed, if you think about it, plaintiff's approach really turns Grutter on its head, because you're not supposed to be a spokesman for your own race, let alone be a spokesman for other minority groups. Now, plaintiffs respond by claiming that Michigan itself lumped together different groups. But this is wrong for several reasons. One, it's wrong as a factual matter. As even Chief Justice Rehnquist's dissent in Grutter acknowledged, Michigan treated Hispanics differently from, not interchangeably with, African Americans. At 380 and 81 of Rehnquist's dissent, he notes, and I quote, that the law school seeks to accumulate a critical mass of each underrepresented minority group. And Rehnquist cites the Michigan brief itself. Second, there's no legal reason, whatever Michigan did, there's no legal reason why UT would be required as a matter of the 14th Amendment to lump together different racial groups. To the contrary, in Parents Involved, the court specifically condemned binary conceptions of race.
Mr. Ho, the one of the things that bothers me about this case is that there is an aspect of this case that's a little bit different from Michigan. We have, in this case, this 10% law with certain results. Since then, we have had a race plus admissions policy with certain results. One of the statements that's made in Grutter is the means chosen to accomplish the asserted purpose must be specifically and narrowly framed to accomplish that purpose. And my question to you is, what is the summary judgment evidence that supports the new theory as opposed to the old 10% plus theory? Because that's a little bit different. They didn't have that in the Michigan case. If you would, please.
Sure. The key evidence in the record is the 2004 proposal that UT put together and relied on. It's a 39-page report. It's at the record CR 2127 through 2151. And that 39-page report goes into detail about what its goals were. It's the same educational interest and diversity that Michigan wanted and that Grutter blessed. You mentioned the top 10% plan, and I think I mentioned earlier that there are a number of problems with their argument about need. One is this notion of the 10% plan as a workable race-neutral alternative. Let's put that aside, even if it is.
Well, we'll get back to that 10% because
sure.
I think it's a different 10% than 10% demographics, but go ahead.
Sure. Even if you take the top 10% plan as a given, as something that we're going to look at. If you look at the proposal at 2156, the 2004 proposal notes that in 2002, if you look at the admissions data, under top 10%, it's 14% African American, and 14% Hispanic, and 3% African American. Now, their whole theory of why we don't have a need is because you slam these two groups together and it exceeds their own baseline of 20%. For one, the 2004 proposal talks about 14 plus 3. That's 17%. It's 14% and 3. So you can't even add them together to get to 20%. We would submit that you can't add them together in any event. And once you take that away, if the panel agrees that lumping together isn't required and, frankly, doesn't make any sense, as they themselves conceded below, if you don't lump together, that's really their entire case. Because at page 43, they acknowledge that if you're going to use any baseline whatsoever, it will be a 20% number, and we're far away from that. We would note that critical mass, of course, isn't a specific number. Grutter really could not have been clearer that we don't use a number, we use a concept.
Well, the concept, as I understand it, that you described is the concept of looking at these representative classes, I mean classrooms, and somehow doing better than at most one black, at most one or two Hispanics. But you yourself said the means has to be chosen to accomplish the objective. And the problem with your system that you've settled on is that it's not, as he put it at the very end, likely to move the needle much. I guess what's your answer to that question? If the means have to be chosen with a view to accomplishing the objective, this isn't going to do it.
Right. Well, we're doing precisely what took place and what was endorsed in Grutter.
Yeah, but Grutter's a different case. This case, you're talking about how many students, was it 364, some such number, in this class of 7,000? And spreading them around among all these different classrooms, you're not going to, as he put it, move the needle much.
Well, they are characterizing our proposal differently than what the proposal actually says. It's not an exclusive reliance on classroom diversity. Classroom diversity is important, as Grutter talks about, but that's merely used to dramatize the campus-wide diversity problem that we have. And that's what the report focuses on. It focuses on both campus-wide numbers, that's at 2156, and it also uses classroom numbers at 2152 to help dramatize the problem, particularly because Grutter talks so much about the issue of classroom discussions and the like.
Mathematically, I think it strikes me as being quite difficult to to distribute, take a minority in the percentages they are, and to get a sufficient number of them to scatter them across that many classes. Any 16% of a total universe of that size divided into the 6,000 classes, and you're going to get this very thin representation. That just mathematically, the odds of that. Plus, you have a lot of these minorities are not that are coming in, as I understand the program too. Many of them are not going to. They're going to tend to. A lot of them are going to be in the softer curriculums and not be in the sciences. Am I right about that?
Yeah. I think where the battle is joined between the two parties, the two sides, is really the notion of what's campus-wide diversity.
Yeah.
They're trying to elevate classroom diversity as the only element. The proposal rejects that notion.
Yeah.
It relies on both.
See, Mr. Ho, one of the other things is that I don't think they talked about classroom diversity in Grutter. And there's another problem here. At the university, you have distinct disciplines, where in law school, in essence, it is a legal discipline, obviously different specialties. So you have, as Judge Higginbotham pointed out, the science, the engineering, the strict number crunchers, for lack of better terminology, which does not necessarily, or should not necessarily, number one, diversity will not increase that discussion necessarily. And how do you apply Grutter when you have this different institution with different disciplines, with one other factor, where the minority high schools that are coming in may not be developing the scientists and engineers in their basic math, calculus, science programs as other high schools.
Well, why don't we, if it'd be helpful, let's just put aside the classroom diversity study completely. Let's just focus on campus-wide.
Absolutely.
Because that's what we know for sure Grutter embraces. We know Grutter looks at campus-wide diversity, and we know Grutter applies not just to law schools, but to the university context. We saw that in Grutter. We saw that, again, in Parents Involved. At the end of the day, the battle is joined at the campus-wide diversity level, and plaintiff's theory, essentially, is this lumping together. If you take away that lumping together, their briefs really don't indicate any other theory.
Well, the university experience is not confined to the classroom as much as some of the, maybe some scholars would like it to be. The university experience is much broader than the classroom as a reality. And the dispersion among individual classes is a signal, an index, but it's just one thing. I don't read any of these cases to that's just a reality. So I'm not sure that the goal of you can set a goal that of here and set it in a way that you're going to get the dispersion across these range of classes, either mathematically or otherwise.
Right. And, Your Honor, I think what makes this case particularly straightforward, based on the record of this case, we are talking about campus-wide diversity problems that the university is trying to address. If I might touch on the issue of deference, and plaintiffs seem to challenge the notion of deference, we would submit that, having talked about this lumping together theory, the court could just resolve this case based on the defects with the lumping theory alone, and really affirm the judgment based on that basis alone. And in fact, we would submit that the court really should just stop there in light of the university's rights under the First Amendment. Under Grutter, and I quote, good faith on the part of a university is presumed, absent a showing to the contrary.
Now, Mr. Ho, does that go into the standard of strict scrutiny when there is a racial factor to be considered?
Absolutely. It's both. It's and I know that they think of this as sort of a curious dichotomy, and the dissenters certainly don't like it.
See, it seems to me that you have to, once that comes into play, if the choice is, the deference choice is race plus, then we have to look at that under strict scrutiny and have to evaluate it under that standard.
No question. It's both. It's both strict scrutiny because of race. It's also deference because of the First Amendment countervailing competing constitutional rights. Their argument is that essentially, you know, you look at that deference only applies to compelling interest. It doesn't apply to narrow tailoring. But that's simply not true. I mean, deference appears in both parts of the court's opinion.
Well, I would think there's deference to the academic assessment of critical mass. And inevitably, to the extent that there's deference to, in that sense, the tightness and fit of means become softer because you don't have a precise target, and the court has not insisted upon a precise target.
Exactly. Deference, and all we have to do is look at Justice Scalia's dissent. Even he acknowledges that the majority is applying deference specifically to strict scrutiny. That's at 348. Look at the opening of Justice O'Connor's entire narrow tailoring discussion. She says that since Bakke, we've never had a narrow tailoring case in this specific context. And she goes on and talks at great length about deference in narrow tailoring, specifically with regard to race-neutral alternatives, specifically with regard to critical mass. She says that Grutter requires only good faith consideration of alternatives at 339. Court should take universities at its word that they will stop using race, switching to race-neutral means as soon as they can. And again, repeating here, presuming good faith of university officials in the absence of a showing to the contrary at 343. And of course, this deference is entirely sensible because of where it comes from. The whole reason why Grutter talks about deference is the university's First Amendment interest in the selection of its student body.
Well, let me ask you about the 10% rule. Everyone describes that as facially neutral, but its whole purpose, admittedly so, is to generate more minorities. And the reality is that that the 10% will reach out and to schools that who are it may not be so academically competitive and will pull in minorities in that fashion. It is working, but it strikes me that it's not being it is not irrelevant to this in the sense that that's just a happenstance and there is no racial. That's not part of the university's program to increase diversity. It admittedly, it seems to me, is. I take it. I mean, it's not a facially neutral. I mean, it's facially neutral, yes, but its whole purpose, the 10% rule, is a response to Hopwood.
I agree with Your Honor, and Justice Kennedy in Parents Involved makes clear that dichotomy, but of course he agrees that that's entirely permissible.
I'm assertion that it's irrelevant. It seems to me that it's very relevant, and then where it takes you is a different matter, but Counsel Opposite thinks, of course, it's quite relevant because he says that you don't need to add more to it.
I see that my time is up.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, we ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Seven.
Thank you. May it please the court. I wanted to go quickly to Judge Garza's question about the purpose here of the university's plan and add in addition to what the state said, that one of the key emphases in the university's policy proposal, which is also quoted in the district court's opinion at page 602, is to create an open pathway to leadership for the state of Texas. The plaintiffs talked about cultural factors and the distinctive aspects of the state can go into this analysis that Grutter acknowledges that the notion of what a university is trying to do in terms of to achieve critical mass is part of its educational mission.
Yeah, Mr. Sibbett, you know, that was Michigan's law school's purpose. Now, it's been kind of incorporated now into the legal principles, but that legal purpose is a little bit different from the Bakke purpose of educational benefit. There seems to be a little bit of a tension between these two concepts and whether or not the leadership that Michigan Law School was talking about is the same leadership that you're talking about at the University of Texas. Now, can other universities also accomplish that same mission?
I mean, I think that in the educational judgment of the University of Texas here, it is a preeminent training ground, the undergraduate school for leaders, and that needs to be part of its analysis in order, as it said, to achieve its mission, that to achieve its mission in classrooms for all sorts of different fields, whether they are ultimately people who go to law school or many other professions, that those routes, diversity in those routes is a reality in the state of Texas as it is elsewhere, but particularly in the state of Texas. And given that reality, preparing leaders for those environments is critically important.
What do you say to those that would argue that the 10% rule is better than the racial plus factor theory on the basis that those 10% individuals had to compete for that 10% within the high schools that they were competing in? Now, they were given those, and they can't change the high school or the dynamics of the high school, but within that framework, they competed as best as they could in that top 10%, and that is a factor that should be acknowledged.
I think that can be acknowledged, purely consistent with what Grutter said and what the university did here. Admitting some students through that route may well be important and have important benefits, and it seems like it does, but there are also other interests.
Different purposes. They're different.
Right, different. But there are also other interests that the university is trying to achieve here.
Sure.
It's trying to achieve a broadly diverse class, and that's a critical importance to get students that are tuba players and football players, as well as students who will contribute to the broad racial diversity of Texas's student body and then prepare leadership beyond that. I wanted to address,
My purpose in this is that to be a leader, one has to compete in all areas, from high school to college, and especially after education. competition is something that has to be done. And if the 10%, and I don't know what the summary judgment record is on this, and this is, I think, crucial, but if the summary judgment record seems to indicate that there's a greater retention rate, for instance, or that there was a development or increase of minorities over a period of time, would that fulfill Grutter's purposes better than the present system?
I think Grutter was very clear that a university doesn't have to completely trade off one of its missions for another mission, that you can be a selective and high-quality environment. You can also achieve broad diversity. Both are important, and there are different ways to contribute to that in the admissions process. That complex educational judgment, important to defer to it in terms of how the university is trying to shape a very selective student body. To come to the classroom study point that was raised earlier, which we think is important evidence, not sole evidence, and just to make two points on that, we cited studies in our record that even a small increase in the number of African Americans in the classroom has a measurable effect on African American students' achievement, comfort in classroom, ability not to be racial spokesmen for the race, and that are all important elements of Grutter. In addition, I think that there's no evidence in this record that there's any clustering of students in particular places to respond to some of the questions raised, that there was isolation across the board for African Americans and Latinos.
The African American dynamics is way different from the Hispanic dynamics at the University of Texas.
Right. And the problem with the lumping phenomenon lumping together prevents the university from having, in its sensitive judgment, the ability to deal with all. But I think that important for Latinos as well is the need to have a visibly open pathway to leadership. Thank you. If there are no further questions.
Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan. I listened quite carefully to Mr. Ho. It appears to me that the university is abandoning the classroom as the benchmark because I think they cannot answer our question on moving the needle. What are they doing about it? Did they analyze it? They're free to go back and do something like that, but I don't think we can consider that passes strict scrutiny. So Mr. Ho says battle is joined at the campus level. And he says, well, you're lumping up Hispanics and African Americans in one number. And there are two points to make on that. One, that's how they do it. If you're underrepresented, and they're treated exactly the same in the plus system.
But the dynamics, the underlying dynamics, are horribly different.
They might well be different, and Texas could have because
of... In other words, you have to focus on the separate groups individually, it seems to me. I mean, in a holistic method, it seems to me that the factors... of consideration are different.
I understand that one could do a distinct analysis and say, do we have a critical mass of group A and group B and group C and treat them differently? That's quite possible. It's not what happened here. This is strict scrutiny of what they did, not what they might do if they went back and redid it and looked more precisely at their problem.
Is one of your points that if you take race out and let all those other factors, you know, poverty, one-parent family, et cetera, across the board, are you suggesting that's the best method by which to proceed?
Well, that was the pre-existing system. And if you look very carefully at what they've said, if they had added to those special circumstances the ability to achieve understanding across racial lines, which is a neutral criteria, be exactly where they are today, because they'll say race is important for white students as well as minority students. So if it all comes down to a non-racial consideration, that is your ability to cross racial lines, that's not a racial test, then there's certainly an alternative that would get them as far as they're getting today. And that is just add it to the special circumstances, integrate it. This is a system that doesn't yield at the plus factor, I think Judge King pointed out,
lumping together Black minorities and Latino minorities as a, it strikes me as on its face, in the teeth of, of this whole teaching from the high court. You know, in voting rights cases, we under application of the Jingles test and tagging single-member districts, we faced years ago this question of the aggregation of, for example, of Latinos and blacks for purposes of voting, and we long ago rejected that because the focus has to be they're different values, and to me you're really moving into group treatment, which is racial.
Well,
by aggregating, that's one of the things.
And Judge Ingemeyer, we're not the ones who insisted on aggregating. If you look at their study, it's done in the aggregate. It looks at the total presence of underrepresented minorities on the campus. And they don't say, well, at some point we're going to satisfy through our non-racial means our Hispanic problem. We'll separately address our minority. And there's one.
So if you had, if 18% of that 21 number were Asian high achievers, would that meet your standards?
Well, I mean, there are, Asians are not treated as underrepresented for the purpose of admission. They are treated as underrepresented for the purpose of studying classrooms. They don't give them any plus factor in admission.
I'm
Asians
the
are.
Aggregation, your quarrel with the aggregate, this 21%, and you group that together, and I was just trying to understand the implications of that.
Well, you know, I think it goes back to the foundational principle of Grutter, which was Justice Powell's decision in Bakke. And here's what he said. When government decisions touch upon an individual's race or ethnic background, he is entitled to a judicial determination that the burden he is asked to bear on that basis is precisely tailored to serve a compelling government interest. And that's the importance of judicial review. And the reason you look, to some extent, at the gross number is that it's a zero-sum game. You only have so many places, and the more you invade those places with preferences, the less room you give for the talented Asian student, the less room you give to our plaintiffs here who are very competitive white students. They are asked to bear the burden, and they're owed a compelling justification by the state, and that is what has not happened here. Judge Garza, to answer your specific question is how has the top 10 affected performance at what Texas said about that in their top 10% report called the Top 10% Laws Working for Texas, minority students earned higher grade point averages than in 1966 and had higher retention rates. And this is their comment on the benefit of what happened in the 1999 class with the top 10 applied. You had people who were achievers. They came to the top 10 because they worked harder than anybody else. And that had a demonstrable impact on performance at the University of Texas.
But
I don't know why they're running away from the top 10.
But the response that Mr. Evans gave me is that the university has the right to choose other goals. The goals in this particular case was a diverse student body.
Correct.
How do you answer that?
I think we said they can set the goals, and the court has accorded them some deference in saying, okay, one of our goals for the state of Texas is to create a diverse student body as a learning tool for everybody in it. We accept that. But having a goal doesn't validate the means. The question is, what are you doing to get from here to there, whether you're at the station already or you're not, and even if you're not, how do you tailor something which crosses racial lines, which imposes race as little as possible to get from here to there. That's what this case is about. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll call the last case for the morning, Casa Orlando Apartments.